Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're covering Season 3, Episode 5, titled Kissed by Fire, which I don't think they could have picked a better name for this episode. There's a lot of fire.
There is a lot of fire.
A lot of Lord of the Light.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people being kissed. It's real good.
And all kinds of body parts.
Yeah. Yeah, all over the place.
A lot of steamy, unconventional sexual energy. The ghost of Sean Connery just possessed my body. I don't know what happened.
Understandable for this episode. What'd you think?
Yeah, like you said, it's I really like it. I thought it was cool to see, like, this is, you know, for people that are fans of Jaime, you know, or looking to see, you know, him kind of turn from the heel character to the face. Like, this episode is the thing that has done the most so far to be like thinking maybe there's different layers of this guy. If you low key Brienne Jaime shipper, you get a lot of red meat for that diet. You get Tywin, you know, once again befuddling all his children, regardless of their standing in his eyes. You got Jon's hot tub scene in the north. You got a pretty good one on one duel. Yeah, it's pretty much all good.
It is. For people watching the video today, we're wearing some pretty apt clothing. We're both wearing red today.
Battle red for Thursday in the studio.
Yeah, this podcast is kissed by fire too.
Oh, you know the other thing. Oh, that's clever. That we should have planned it out beforehand. Also, like, there's not a lot of human moments that Stannis gets, and this episode's one of them. You know, the fact that he has got a little bit of a soft spot for his little girl, that his not even
now
his wife
he's
shares.
Been humbled.
Yeah.
Now that he doesn't have concerns outside of his family, sure.
Yeah. Well, you think so? I mean, I don't think this comes out of this. I don't think this springs from nothing. Like, he's got to have had a
little
bit.
Yeah, but he's been brought low, and now all of a sudden he cares what his family thinks. I get it. He had a war to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a throne to claim, but he did not seem too concerned with his family or their well-being for most of this series.
You're not one to declare him Stannis de Manis.
Not because he goes and visits his daughter one time. No. Yeah.
All right.
Got to be a better father than that to get Manis status. Anyway, yeah, I really like this episode too. I thought there are a couple of like really good scenes that are low-key some of the best scenes, I think, in this episode. Like, there's obviously the Jaime and Brienne stuff, which I loved. But there's the stuff with Littlefinger and Sansa. And, like, Littlefinger's play to... you know, the battle rages between Olenna and Margaery and Littlefinger and the control for Sansa in the North. And then when you combine that with Tywin's look at it and the stuff that he's making his kids do for the realm, or rather for his dynasty, I think it's just really, really good political drama here, too. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what I'm in Game of Thrones for.
Yeah, so. No, the behind-the-scenes, like, you know, cat-and-mouse game between Varys and Littlefinger and Tywin and the Tyrells. We saw, you know, pretty things mostly go Varys and Tyrell's way, and now it seems things are mostly going... And, like, I thought it was so, you know, it's so cool to see Tywin kind of, like... bring his children along with, like, well, you can't risk pissing on it. He goes, what are you talking about? This is a plot. By definition, that means no, like, if they came and said, you can't do that, we were plotting against you, then...
Right.
Like, it's so elementary, and it shows that he's playing the game on the next level.
Yeah. And some good... some other good stuff. We'll talk about it. Are we ready to get into the episode recap?
I believe so.
Okay.
Hey, before we get to the episode, as always, want to talk about what's going on here. A bald move this week. Of course, you know, we've got Better Call Saul Season 4 has returned. We did the first episode. We're also doing something like we did with Westworld, the instant talk. Every Monday night, right after the episode airs, we get online. And if you're a club member, you can log in to baldmove.com, follow the link, and do live chats with us. Get your own feedback and your first impressions in there. And we release it as a podcast. It's a lot of fun. If you're a club member, check it out. Still doing Sharp Objects on HBO. Really entertaining, psychological kind of murder mystery thriller kind of action. We are also doing first run bald movies. Tonight we're checking out Spike Lee's latest Black Klansman.
Oh boy.
I have no idea what to expect.
Me either.
It looks like it's going to be entertaining, though. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, every 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday and Thursday, Jim and I get on twitch.tv/baldmove, and we play video games, and we hang out with chat and talk with people. Also, if you're a club member, we dropped a quip, one of the last quips before it goes on hiatus for a bit. Quit Your Pitchin' is a show where Jim and I generate fake titles of television shows and movies, and then we try to come up with funny or interesting pitches for them that we trade back and forth. And on a personal note, Kickstarter for the Game of Thrones book, God of Thrones, that I'm writing with a religious scholar about the many religions of Westeros and Essos, just concluded yesterday. It raised over $17,000 to publish and edit and typeset and hire art for the books. And I just want to say thank you so much for your support on that project. If you are a backer, stay tuned, because you'll be getting some emails about what to do next, deadlines and things coming up. And if you're not, write on your calendar November. Circle the entire month, because sometime in November, the book Gods of Thrones will come out, and I'm sure we'll have announcements for then. But I just want to say thank you for all your support on that.
We're getting geared up for the 6th Annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And let's get to the episode.
We start off with the Hound's trial by combat. Beric uses a flaming sword, which really spooks the Hound. However, the Hound manages to kill him anyway, and Arya, angered by the injustice, runs at the Hound to try and kill him until everyone notices that Beric has come back to life, and that kind of brings the party to an end.
He didn't just kill him, he, like, Rob Roy'd him. Like, yeah. This guy was from shoulder to sternum just, like, kind of hinging open like some kind of grisly accordion.
I really don't know how this bringing someone back to life in that status works, because it didn't seem like... I mean, at this point, his arm is, like, hanging on by a thread. Half his body is hanging on, barely.
I wonder if the Lord of Light, like, somehow sears the flesh shut or something. Because, yeah, like, if he just came back to life, it'd be some kind of hideous monkey paw.
Yeah.
You know, industrial accident-looking thing walking around. But,
And they make it clear that, you know, the scars stick with him,
sure,
right? There's some physical healing that needs to take place here. So,
yeah.
I don't know if he's going to be able to use that arm.
That's the thing when you're dealing with magic. It's, you know, especially Martin in these early seasons really plays close to the vest about what exactly is possible. It's it's very magic in the way, like, you hear about it in like period, the way, like, the ancients would talk about it. Like, it's just shit that would happen. And, like, who can explain it? Like, there's not a whole lot of, like, Brian Sanderson style, well, he ingested this minute copper dust and he added it with some mercury and then he swallowed some iron for good measure and presto changeo, his bones re-knitted because it's just like, you know, he breathed the Lord's fire into him and he's back on his feet.
Mm-hmm.
Done deal. No more story.
Yeah.
Lazarus called and, or Jesus called and Lazarus came out of the grave. Like, there you go.
You don't even know how it happened, just that it did.
Yeah. The power of R'hllor compelled him.
I love it when Beric lights up his sword because there's only one thing that scares the Hound and Beric's got it. Unfortunately, I think that's also the thing that did him in here because I think it weakened his sword somehow.
Could be.
And allowed the Hound to just slice right through it.
Right.
Right through it.
Well, we see this, like, you know, this trying to recreate Lightbringers happened a couple times. It was, you know, Melisandre when Stannis drew his sword from the burning idols of the Seven. The backstory of Thoros of Myr is that he would get, you know, drunk and participate in the tourneys with his flaming sword. So, like, this is an attempt to rekindle that fabled weapon that supposedly blazed of its own accord. But yeah, I never thought of it that way, that it could have been like a flaw in the, expose a flaw in the metallurgy.
Maybe. I don't know how, you know, but forging and blacksmithing on all that works, but
it's a cool effect, and
it is, and it levels the playing field a bit,
yeah,
because the Hound is visibly frightened,
yeah, and he's got this kind of like Frankenstein monstrous quality as he's kind of like stomping through the fire and raging and roaring like a bull, and the lighting where like this set just looks like it's lit from the sword and the participants' own things being aflame, like the
kind of reminds me of like some of those Star Wars scenes where the lightsaber duels,
like
the between
Bespin,
Dooku
and the Bespin chamber and Dooku,
right,
and Anakin and Kenobi,
pretty cool,
and
the Hound gets kissed by fire in this.
He sure does. Kissed with a fist by fire. Mm-hmm. Arya, her horror at like this turn of events,
yeah,
this is classic Game of Thrones. Like, you think the good guy's going to win, and then they don't, and people react in horror.
I don't know that I felt like the good guy was going to win in this scenario. I mean, the Hound is legendary.
Yeah, but, like, I felt like in the narrative of the scene, like, there was a clear momentum shift where Beric, like, it's almost like he needed to get rid of the shield and just, like, you know, have this onslaught and just really push the Hound. And then when the Hound's shield caught on fire, I'm like, you know, I was a book reader at this point, so I already knew it was going to happen. But, like, I thought they did a pretty good job of telling, but this narratively, Beric is winning this fight until... Yeah, sword broke, and his whole upper half of his body almost separated at the shoulder.
Yeah. All right, then we go on to Tormund and Orel, I guess is this guy's name. I don't know. He's the guy who controls the birds. Questioning Jon to find out what he knows of the Night's Watch numbers and their whereabouts along the wall. Ygritte intervenes when things begin to turn violent, and then steals Jon's sword, leading him into a cave, where she tests his loyalties by tempting him to break his Night's Watch vows by having sex with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. And afterward, they talk about their former lovers, in John's case, none, and take a bath together. I guess maid is their word for virgin.
Yeah.
Judging by contextual clues here.
Yeah. I think, and she's kind of poking fun at John's girlish ways, I think.
Yeah,
in her mind.
His soft ways. They're harder up there in the north.
Before I say anything else, I want to, because I remember raging against this in the old podcast I was on. There is a hot tub 30 feet from this wilding camp, and only John and Ygritte use it. Like, I feel as though there would have been a mile-long door. There'd be people pounding at the door after your 5 minutes are up. This whole, like, yeah, oh, we all want to stay in the cave forever, but we got to take our turn. Like, I mean, I get that they're, like, wild and free and they're tough, but, like, they clearly don't completely eschew creature comfort because Ygritte knew about it. And it's like, yeah, it's getting naked. This is fun. This feels better. This feels better than huddling in animal skins outside.
In the freezing cold, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I feel like the when they jumped in the pool, Tormund should have been there the whole time, like, chomping on a chicken leg, being like, thanks
just watching.
Thanks, dinner and a show, you know?
That'd be great.
Yeah. Like, this should be a bunch of wildlings in loincloth when you pan out, just lounging and watching John. And Ygritte's like, oh, You thought we'd have this cave to ourselves? You know nothing, Jon Snow. But yeah, come on. This thing would be a destination.
Fair. Yeah, she really is just taken by what Jon does with his mouth here. Some pleasant things. Although I think low key the most shocking thing in this scene is that Ygritte has fucked a thin.
Yeah.
Ygritte has fucked a thin.
Yeah.
Like, be careful. They'll do something less pleasant with their mouths than Jon did.
They're not going in for the Lord's kiss.
No.
They're into that Vore shit you read about on the dark sites parts of the internet.
I was shocked by that.
I also thought it was interesting, Jon trying to find the right place to draw the line between being honest with his, you know, with his mission and, like, trying to dissuade them from butchering everybody at Castle Black, because he's given, you know, everything he said about the castles, which ones were manned is true, which I think also the wildlings would know, but he's clearly lying about the 1,000, you know, Black brothers hiding out at Castle Black. But, you know, I don't think John would, you know, like it you got to ask yourself, like, when would John draw the line between his mission and, like, you know, what's counterproductive and assaulting Castle Black. So, like, by the time the wildlings found out he's full of shit, he'd probably turn cloak anyway. But it's
clearly
a constant,
it's not his vows. Like, that's not the line.
Right. And, you know, I'm sure Corrin Halfhand would look down from the old god's heaven and be like, you fucked that wilding boy. You fucker. you kill me, but you won't fuck just because you fuck your vow. But it sets up a lot of tension because we know, or we suspect, rather, that Jon Snow is not, you know, going to just become a wildling. But he is getting in pretty deep emotionally with this wildling girl. Mm-hmm. And she has no problems with assaulting Castle Black. Mm-hmm. How is that going to play out?
Yeah, good question. So we go over to the Hound, who's pissed that the Brotherhood won't give back the money from his coin purse. They hood him and they lead him away to his freedom. They honor the trial by combat result. Let him go.
Mm-hmm. That's how the legend of Robin Hood started. They robbed these brigands and they put hoods on them and they kicked them out of the cave. And it all got corrupted in history, and, you know, when Westeros got declared the United Kingdom, it's just, you know, that's part of the historical record that got eschewed.
They do have an archer. Pretty good one at that.
They do.
Then Jaime is delivered to Roos, who treats his prisoner, I think, at this point. I think Brienne is freed. Treats the prisoner with more respect than this other, I don't know, the guy who cut his hand off did.
Yeah, Locke,
yes. Jaime asks about his family, and Roose toys with him for a second before telling him that they're alive and well, and then he sends the ill Jaime to Qyburn for treatment.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, like, Locke rides up, and he is not under the impression that Roose Bolton would have a single problem with anything he did, and there's, like, a little bit of a cockeyed, like, what the hell are you going on about, as Roose is just, like, putting on this elaborate show of how courtly he's being and how much respect he's going to give to his captors. And, you know, I think you're supposed to notice that. I'll put it that way. These are things that that should be noticed as we're progressing through the series.
All right, we go to Qyburn, who's working on Jaime. He tells him that that he's no longer a maester because of his bold experiments, as he puts it. Jaime refuses to let him amputate the rest of his arm, so Qyburn cuts away what flesh has rotted as Jaime screams in pain.
That's exactly what happened.
Unsettling scene here. Yeah. There's not much to say about it other than, I guess, this idea that Qyburn is no longer a maester.
Yeah.
Because they called him a maester earlier in the show.
Right.
We find out that he's not exactly that.
Yeah, what you know, what kind of expand. You get a little bit of, they do a good job of the lighting here. Qyburn has got, like, the way that he sits in the shaft of light really illuminates and makes his eyes look almost bleached out and pale, like very almost vampiric. And then the way his eyes gleam as he's hurting Jamie, you know, like kind of like you don't know the full story here, but there's something spooky and maybe a violation of Hippocratic Oath about this guy, this former maester who was stripped of his chains. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like you're going to cut away still living flesh and then pour boiling wine onto it. What? I know that this is something that gets brought up in feedback and we might as well consider it now. Why do you think Jamie was dead set against taking Milk of the Poppy?
I almost feel like it's some sort of punishment to himself, but I don't know exactly what for.
He's doing penance?
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
That's
honestly
one of the things. Like I thought that maybe he feels like he deserves all this. And he's using his pain to kind of like purge himself of these other negative feelings. It could be that he still might want to try and escape and he doesn't want his senses dulled by the Milk of the Poppy. You know, the other thing is like, Milk of the Poppy is essentially opium. And I wonder if he suspects like that it'd be very easy to kill him with an overdose. But then again, like he's such a valuable political prisoner. That would be foolish.
Yeah.
But yeah, they don't really. It doesn't seem like Jamie's a type that would, you know, do away with unnecessary pain. I think this is also a reaction to Brienne being like, "You big wuss! Like you have just had this little bitty problem, and you're already throwing yourself a pity party." So he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna try on all the pain I can get out of the situation." Hmm. But it's an interesting choice for him to do that.
Is he gonna become a masochist? Is that what's happening here?
Could be. Is Brienne into that kind of thing? We'll have to see.
I don't know.
Did we mention the fact that like Roose Bolton just mercilessly fucking with Jaime about the fate of King's Landing and his sister?
I haven't really mentioned it. I mean, I said that he toys with him.
I mean, it's like it's like one of those E channel shows where it's like, you know, your sister did not.
What's a Jerry Springer
not survive
episode?
The sack and rape of King's Landing, which didn't happen because your father rode the raid to save the day until, like, he really stretched it out. Stretched out the moment.
No, he does. He does. he's not going to torture Jamie physically, but mentally,
psychological torture, okay.
Why not? All right, so Cersei goes to Littlefinger to ask for his help in dealing with the Tyrell threat and tells him essentially to do a better job than he did finding Arya Stark. Mm. Which, you know, we'll put Littlefinger into motion later in this episode.
Yep. And also not that, but like just to kind of look under the dirt. Look under the House Tyrell's fingernails. See if you can dig up any dirt, which ends up manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. And then Olenna sits down with Tyrion, who asks her to scale back the wedding a bit to spare the coffers during the time of war they're in.
Right.
Olenna lists the many ways that the Tyrells have supported King's Landing, and tells Tyrion that the royal wedding is meant to distract the small folk, and that's the purpose of extravagance here.
Right.
She then agrees to pay for half the wedding herself, which satisfies Tyrion.
Yeah, and I love how she just effortlessly keeps him off balance throughout the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, she comes here and she demands figs so she can have her bowel movement, which, like, blows Tyrion's mind. And then Pod starts pouring a Tyrian-sized wine glass, and she's like,
"Oh, Tyrion Squire has a heavy hand with the wine. Imagine
right.
that."
Right, yeah. So now he's kind of feeling apologetic about that. And then he tries to hit her with how extravagant the wedding, and she's like, "Look at all these millions of bushels," and so on and so forth. And yeah. You know, here I expected this epic, you know, sharp-tongued winch, and I find a brow-beaten bookkeeper. Like, she just... And then, with very little negotiation, gives him half of what he wants.
I was kind of surprised by that at the end.
Yeah, because it seems...
It's almost like she's just having fun, even though she's determined to, you know, help where she can.
Yeah. I wonder if it's to sell the plot. Like, she doesn't want... Like, she's going to, you know, make Tyrion feel like he worked with it, but also be so generous that it's not going to be something that Tywin is like, oh, you know, starts to suspect that they're not completely on his side or whatnot.
Right. She's standing her ground on having the extravagant wedding, but giving up a little to,
right,
you know, to keep that.
Because I think that she could have drove a much harder bargain because she's in the right. Like, look at all, we rode to your rescue. Without us, you guys wouldn't even, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah.
I could have just waited for King's Landing to be sacked and have my daughter marry the next person that's going to sit on the Iron Throne.
How
I
many
guess
of
it would
those...
be Stannis, and that wouldn't work, but...
yeah.
You know?
Probably not.
Yeah, who would she... Because Stannis already married, Renly's dead, Robert's dead, Shireen is not going to marry Margaery and make her a queen for sure. Maybe that's why they bit back that whole... I wonder if like that's what the complex... That came into the complex calculations of the Tyrell. That backing Stannis would... Yeah, Stannis would be grateful and like recognize their zeal loyalty, but then what?
Yeah, he's already got a wife.
Yeah, like getting married into the royal family and joining that dynasty of Tywin seemed like a much more attractive offer.
Yeah. So Gendry tells Arya that he's going to be the Brotherhood's blacksmith, and he's sticking around with him. Arya's sad, but when Gendry explains that he'd much rather be free to make his own choices than serve Robb or any other man, Arya offers to be his family, but Gendry tells her that that can never happen because she'd be his lady, not his family.
Yeah.
She's Highborn. He's not. He's a bastard, so not exactly family material.
Right. Not even Jon Snow was really your family if you talked to your lord, your lady
right.
mother.
It's a pretty sad scene. I mean, it's... Because Arya's sad that she may not even have a family anymore, right?
Right.
Her father's been killed. Her brothers are in the wind. Her oldest brother and mother are off to war. Yeah. They might be killed. Like, she doesn't know who her family is. She's looking for one.
Her sister is essentially a hostage in a hostile land.
So, like, when Gendry says, hey, I can't be whatever it is you want me to be, specifically any part of your family, it's kind of crushing to her.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty moving because Maisie really... turned up the cute wounded quality when she's like, I can be your family, and her voice is kind of breaking, and he gently says, you'd be my lady. Man, that's a great scene, underrated amongst all the other high drama in the episode, but she's really bringing the thunder here.
Let's get to some high drama. Lord Karstark breaks into the cells where the Lannister boys are being kept and kills them both, and then when Robb finds out, he sends Lord Karstark to the dungeon, orders the rest of his men hanged while he consults with his posse here. Edmure suggests that they bury the boys and don't let the word of their deaths get out. Robb believes he has to kill Karstark for the honor, essentially to honor justice here. Everyone else believes that'd be a huge mistake that would drive the Karstarks from his army, and Robb decides he's going to stick to his principles, and he beheads Lord Karstark. In a scene that I think is unlike other beheadings we've seen in Game of Thrones, like, Ned's beheading, there's a shitload of fanfare, and rightfully so. Mm. He's an important person in Westeros, but this one is sort of underplayed, and I like it.
Yeah, and it's in the downpouring rain. It really shows that this is, like, not a triumphant occasion for anyone.
Yeah.
Like, even when he gives him the last word, Karstark uses the devastating, like, you know, kill me and be cursed by our own laws. Like, you know, the history of the Starks and the Karstarks are... they are the same family. The Karstarks became the Starks when they were bequeathed this fortress, the Karhold, and they put that as part of their names, but they are kin. So Robb is literally a kinslayer, which is one of the more accursed things you can be in the weird religions of this country, of this nation. And then you're no king of mine. I mean, I think Robb realized that his mom and Talisa were going to be right, that as soon as their lord renounced him as a king.
Yeah.
And I think he also starting to feel, I'd say that he's starting to feel like he's that the war is lost, but then he has that kind of triumphant scene where he gets the idea to assault Casterly Rock at the end.
I mean, I think they both have points here.
Yeah.
Everyone's got a point. You know, Karstark has a point when he says, I killed your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's not treason. Robb, you know, views it as treason because he went against Robb's wishes, essentially. Mm-hmm. You can't disobey the king without it being treason.
Yeah.
And then all of his posse has a really good point about the Karstarks leaving them if he does this. But Robb has that part of Ned in him, right? That respect for honor.
Right.
And this is what honor requires of him. This is what justice requires.
I don't think that Ned would have broken a marriage alliance
Yeah, I agree.
The same way that, I mean, that's the thing where he doesn't quite have, like, he's got Ned's, like, foolishness and stupidity and kind of blindness to, like, the politics and, you know, kind of taking the temperature of a room. But he also doesn't quite have that, like, iron core of willpower and that oak-like integrity and righteousness, you know, with the exception of, you know, Ned supposedly cheating on his wife while he was off at war.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's, you know, there's definitely a fine line between honor and justice and righteousness, right? Like all of those things are not necessarily one and the same, and they can be at odds many times. And I feel like that's where Rob is himself. You know, honor demanded that he marry the Walder Frey girl.
Right.
He chose to go with his heart on that and break that honor, but. Here, justice demands something of him, right?
Mm-hmm. He thinks it does.
And he's got a choice to make between honoring the kinship with the Karstarks or meeting out justice here.
Yeah. And he's trying to draw the bright line of, well, you murdered children.
Right.
I think Karstark,
but I don't think it's that easy. I don't think it's that simple.
No, I think Karstark engineered this cleverly because he should have kept Karstark in prison and as a hostage to make sure that his house stays loyal to him. That'd been a smart play, and that's exactly what he did to his mother. Mm-hmm. Like, when his mother defied him and broke the law and let go, you know, Jaime Lannister unilaterally, he imprisoned him. It seems like that's kind of, like, over now. But, like, I think Karstark was wanting to see, and I don't know whether he expected him, because it seems like he did expect him to, like, oh, he's going to scold me and then, you know, send me on my way. But he's also saying it with such disrespect. I think he was trying to provoke the other reaction, because now he wants to either have the satisfaction of proving that this young wolf is soft or bring the young wolf down.
Yeah.
Because he's had it up to here with his, you know, distraction. Like, that's what Rob, that's Rob's problem. He's just, he doesn't, you know, like, why are we here? We were here to save your father, or then we are here to avenge your father and the North sense of honor and propriety, and you are chasing tail.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous. And it is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, I really hate people to defend Rob and that. Because
that decision is impossible to defend.
It's indefensible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you could have avoided making the marriage compact with Walder Frey, and you could have built a fucking bridge and gone around or taken time, whatever, but you needed to get across. So once you did that, you either keep your word to the people who are your bannermen, or why are people your bannermen?
Yeah.
And there's, like, really not much you can defend it, like, on human terms, but leadership and king terms?
No. And that's Rob's, I feel like that's Rob's biggest fault, is he follows his heart a little too much.
And he's a kid.
Because, like, look at, I just think this would have gone very differently. And in fact, it did go very differently when kids weren't involved. When, you know, his mom releases Jamie, she essentially gets a slap on the wrist, sent to time out for a little bit, and now she's back. Karstark makes, I don't even want to call it a mistake, but he makes the choice to kill these children, which I very much think reminds Rob of his brothers, who, for all he knows, are dead right now. And and probably at the hand just like someone like Karstark. So.
Right.
Like, that's the thing in my mind that pushes him from, like, the slap on the wrist scolding to the beheading is realizing the parallel there.
It still is.
Or maybe not even realizing it intellectually, but in his heart
subconsciously,
he feels it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's still an emotional decision that a king should be above, but...
Yeah, sure.
That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't...
That's
Rob's
flaw.
I understand Rob, but I don't condone it.
Right.
That's the key. Like, I can understand, I try to be empathetic and understand where people are coming from, but, you know, it's like, okay, I get you came by all this honestly, but still, you can't do that, man.
Yeah.
You can't excuse it.
All right, we go over to Arya asking Thoros what they're going to do with her. He says they're going to take her to her brother and collect a reward, which sounds an awful lot like her to as being a hostage, essentially. Beric explains to Arya how he keeps coming back to life via Thoros and the Lord of Light. And he says it's getting harder to come back, and he feels like he's losing a bit of himself every time. Arya asks Thoros if he can bring back a man without a head, which, of course, he can't. She's talking about her father there, in case anybody missed that.
She's happy to a Thoros pretty didn't. Sick Dr. Seuss rhyme. Can you bring him back without a head? Can you bring him back if his name is Ned? How dead is dead, she said. Anyway.
Do you want to say anything about this? The Lord of the Light?
I really like. I mean, there's a lot of like really clever wordplay with the whole like, well, yo, so I'm a hostage. You are, you know, you are and you aren't. It's more than I am, and I really liked that. And then, you know, like this stuff with the, it's given the backstory of Barrick, and you know, reminds us the last time that we saw him, he was being sent forth to bring the mountain to justice, and. In fact, the mountain brought him to death, but and also the idea that like Thoros is just as mystified that this stuff is working because Thoros is a failed priest.
Yeah,
he was sent here to convert Bobby B. Bobby B. converted him to the religion of tits and wine, and he's just been like this failed. It'd be like a televangelist that actually faith healed someone. Like what a like a mind fuck that would be for them. Like I didn't even believe this is real, and what the. I really like this backstory that they do effortlessly in a single scene.
Mm-hmm. Then we go over to Stannis' wife, Selyse, who is praying to the Lord of the Light when Stannis shows up. Selyse tells him not to give up and that he'll be victorious eventually. Stannis confesses that he has laid with the Red Woman. He's been kissed by fire, but she already knows because Melisandre has told her everything. She's happy that Melisandre was able to give him the son that she couldn't. And this scene... What the fuck are these fetuses in jars, man? I mean, obviously, they're. It seems, based on context, they're failed efforts to give Stannis a son.
Right. Stillborn.
But
or...
why is she keeping them around? What? Other than really sweet alien resurrection style decorations for this drab ass room.
I feel like the showrunners, I feel like the Double D's went a little too far to make Selyse creepy and weird.
Yeah.
Like, they don't need to amp up everything to 11 because this is not in the books. So like, I don't know. Like, I guess they're like, well, Cersei talked about losing a child. So we can't have someone else do that and be sympathetic. So let's like make sure that everyone knows that this woman's not just like a deluded brainwashed cult member, but she's also like emotionally disturbed. I think it's more effective to portray people that are deluded and brainwashed as normal folk because it's more horrifying. And I think that's how it actually happens. Like, yeah, sure. Sometimes, yeah. You know, cults and, you know, religious swindlers take advantage of people with emotional or mental disturbances. More often, they just get you all twisted up. And I think that's scarier than someone that's already got a screw loose, you know, just having their machine get shaken apart. So, but yeah, just a whole, like, it is already creepy, the whole, you know, when I found out that you guys had fucked, I wept with joy. You know, and she gave you a son, which in context of what we know what that son is really horrifying.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to pan to the jars of formaldehyde full of fetuses, like the fucking Fields Museum. It's, yeah. Like I said, I'm not a fan of them adding that embellishment, but I know why they did.
Okay.
I understand, but I don't condone.
Fair. So then Stannis goes to see his daughter, Shireen, who asks how the battle went, and she's very excited to see her friend Davos, and he tries to break the news gently that Davos won't be coming to see her because he put him in a cell for treason. We know Shireen doesn't really care. She's gonna head downstairs.
I do like that how Stannis can't even sugarcoat it for his poor daughter afflicted with Dragonscale.
Yeah, no, it's. Is this the first time we've seen Shireen?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. I thought so. I wasn't sure.
And how, like, you know, she's, like, almost in this, like, Quasimodo type of cell that she's locked away, no one can see. And even her mother, like, that's another thing that I thought was a little much, her being, like, you know, well, you got this deformed child, and she's I don't know whether Melisandre's been talking shit about her or what, but, like, she's seen as, like, some kind of abomination, and... It's really sad, but then even knowing all that, Stannis is still like, oh, well, your only friend that gives you all these cool gifts and make it a point to visit you beside me. He's in a dungeon because he's a fucking traitor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Pretty rough shit. Also, detail, the song that she's singing in this episode and through the credits is, in the books, there is a fool called Patchface called that because he's got like a checkerboard pattern tattooed on his face. Mm-hmm. And he was a very clever, nimble lad that survived a shipwreck. And that shipwreck, like, robbed him of his wits. And all he does is babble these, like, sing-song stories that have, like, these very contradictory things. Like, under the sea, the birds have scales and the fish have wings. And, you know, but there's a couple of theories that if you want to get into it, where they analyze the song the Patch Face is singing, and a lot of people think it's the key to the end of Martin, like that like this is all foreshadowing things that are going to happen in like this big apocalyptic ending. Well, we'll see. But that's non spoiler. If you want to dig on that some more, you can search for Patch Face's song and go to town on it. Things get weird in Cthulhu-y.
Yeah. I'd say Davos did better with the shipwreck than Patchface did.
Yeah, he didn't turn into a gibbering pile of motley drool.
No. All right, then we go to one of the highlights of the episode. It's Brienne bathing. That's not the best part.
Yeah, yeah. Gwendolyn Christie's back, muscular backside.
Yeah, muscular buttocks. Jamie shows up to do the same, and he starts in with his usual digs until Brienne gets pissed, and he apologizes to her. And when he sees this look of disdain that he's seen on so many people before, he tells the story of how he got the name Kingslayer, which the short version is King Aerys got paranoid that his enemies were all around him, placed caches of wildfire all over the city, and was going to set them ablaze when Robert Baratheon and Tywin Lannister sacked King's Landing. So Jaime had to kill the king and his pyromancer to protect the entire city. And after he tells the story, he collapses. Yeah. It's a great scene.
By what right does the wolf judge the lion?
Fantastic, and, yeah, from Coaster Waldo.
Yeah. So Jamie's really frustrating because we've heard tell. We might have talked this in the non-spoiler section. I know we talked about it in the spoiler section, but you hear tell from Ned's perspective that when he came into the throne room after the Baratheon forces arrived to kind of secure King's Landing, they find Jamie kind of like irreverently sitting upon the Iron Throne, like, now what? And it's hard to square that image that Ned has with the story that Jaime tells, because there's, like, this story, like, maybe if Jaime had tried harder, maybe, like, what caused Jaime to make that miscalculation? Instead of, like, realizing, he's arguably the hero of King's Landing, but he turns into the Kingslayer and, like, attempted usurper just by, I don't know. And a lot of people, like, I read a lot. A lot of people say, it's just this Jaime's core arrogance. But, like, that's not what's coming out in this scene. So then you start to question, like, how much of this was Jaime thinking in the moment? How much of this was him, like, thinking back on the moment and being rueful now that he's lost his hand? Like, there's a lot of, like, really a lot of depth here to the character, and trying to synthesize this with what you already know of his and have been told about it.
Yeah, I do feel like this is some honesty from Jaime here. I don't think this story is entirely fabricated.
Right.
He's not. Essentially, that is to say, there's a good side to Jaime that often gets ignored because of the way he acts, his arrogance,
right.
The reputation he has from this event. And I really enjoyed, it's partially down to just the straight up performance from this actor. But I also really enjoyed seeing a different side of Jaime, not the side of Jaime that we see at the beginning of this scene where he starts to dig at Brienne. That's what he's always doing.
Right.
He's just playing a game.
Which is a,
here there are no games.
It's defense through a strong offense. Like, he always attacks other people and gets them off balance. So then when they are mad at him or dismissive or offended, well, he's giving them good reason.
Sure.
Not just like, whereas if he comes in with a neutral affect and he sees these sneers and looks, then he knows it's because of, all the shit he's done in his past. So it's a way to, like, deflect all that. But yeah, like, and the fact that, like, when he really tells a story where he tried to give, like, leal counsel to the king and be like, you don't trust my father, he's up to no good, you need to peacefully surrender before this goes all pear-shaped. And then, the king, the pyromancer, this plot to, essentially burn everyone alive and turn himself into a dragon. It's madness. And he said, you know, like you, like if your Renly had asked you to do this, would you have kept your oaths? And there's so many oaths. You got to obey and respect your father. You have to obey and respect the king. What happened? It's a really, really great scene. I also liked the initial reaction where, you know, Jaime uses his, because, you know, Jaime's aware that he's a beautiful man and that, you know, Brienne is kind of an awkward lady, and he uses his body to kind of set her off balance. Mm-hmm. But also he's attractive, so like Brienne's kind of like intrigued. And then when he insults her and she like rushes him naked like a fucking bull moose, and he catches a look at her, but I think there's something like, you know, he's not apologizing just because he realizes shit. I think he's, you know, there's also like an awakening. I don't know. This might be because I'm a little bit of a Brienne and Jaime shipper. But I feel like there's a little bit of awakening to the fact that like this is, I've been mocking this woman and talking about what a great brute she is, but there's also something about her. There's something about Brienne, and I don't know. I see it. So there you go.
I'm saying if Jaime stood up in that scene, they'd have to cut away.
There'd be
Even HBO would have to cut away.
He could. He's sword slinging, no hands. yeah, because it's the one thing HBO can't show, an erect male penis.
Yeah.
Stars has broken through that barrier. Stars, watch American Gods season one, erect male penises from hell to breakfast.
All right.
But HBO, it's not thrown. Television. It's not, they are shy of the erect male penis.
Kind of adding on to what you said about the oaths, I think this episode also plays with that quite a bit, because in this scene, he also says that Varys was counseling Aerys, right? He was also on the side of, hey, don't do this.
Right.
Varys is one of those people who survived through the rebellion and served the king still. But when you look at what Barristan tells Jorah later on, that Robert never trusted him because he, you know, killed some of his friends in battle and he served the other king. It was like, I wonder how there's that conflict there, right? Like, how far was Varys willing to go to protect his king over the realm, right? Clearly about as far as Jaime. So whatever you think of Varys' decisions in that moment, I think you also have to attribute to Jaime.
That's interesting, because I was, if I hear what you're saying right, you're a little bit, because I thought this was further evidence that maybe Varys has been telling the truth all along about him just wanting to serve the realm. Like, you know,
it could be,
a peaceful negotiation, this resolution, rather than opening up the gates to Tywin Lannister's forces, I think would have been better. Like, the sack of King's Landing is, like, legendary for, like, how execution-y and rapey it all got.
Right.
Especially when it came to, like, the royal family. So I think Varys, you know, rather than seeing everyone suffer, would have, I feel like,
His loyalties are seemingly more to the realm than the king. So I kind of view like him being his, Jaime's thoughts being lined up with Varys's as proving that Jaime was also more in line and that this is truth that Jaime's speaking.
Okay, I'll buy that.
As opposed to some fabrication to make himself look good.
I'll buy that.
All right, anyway, we move on to Shireen visiting Davos in the dungeons, and she brings him a book, but it won't do him any good because he can't read. So Shireen offers to teach him and starts with the title of the book, History of Aegon the Conqueror and His Conquest of Westeros.
It's a good word, a good title, because like there's already two words. You get conquer and you're halfway through egg's the other one. It's a very sweet scene because Davos will, you know, he cares enough about Shireen to not make her feel ill about her father, to not, like, you know, because there's two sides to the story. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously he could have been like, no, princess, I tried to save your father, it's the Red Wolf, but he doesn't try, because, you know, what good would it do? He doesn't think that he's getting himself out of this pit, so, like, might as well leave the child's love for her father intact. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was sweet, and the fact that Shireen doesn't really understand that, you know, this guy is going to die by her father's hand, and that he is allowing her to teach him to read, even though he doesn't see much of a future for himself. I thought it was all very sweet, and fucking, I love Davos.
He's interesting. Davos' fate here sort of parallels Jaime's in a little way too, because like treason is such a nebulous term because it's loyalty based, right? Like it's what. What actions are treasonous if they're in service to the king? Because that's what Davos thought he was doing when he tries to kill the Red Woman, when he advises Stannis not to take her. He thought he was doing the right thing there. Can that be treason if you think you're doing the right thing?
I mean, yeah, because, like, I think you can... The king probably judges what treason is.
Absolutely, and... but that's what I mean. It's so nebulous. It can mean whatever he wants, and it's loyalty-based. Right. So whether you're trying to do a good thing or not, it's all how the king perceives it.
Right. It's like, you know, Karstark might say that I wasn't being disloyal either, but he's still going to lose his head.
Yeah. Then we cut right from that title over to Dany. Well, actually, Jorah. He's recounting the siege of Pyke. And his knighting ceremony, where he nearly pissed on the king's boots, he had to go so bad, to an entertained Barristan, who explains that he's spent his life honoring vows to kings who didn't deserve his loyalty, and now he wants to know what it's like to fight for someone he believes in.
When he asks Jorah if he believes in her, with all my heart, because he's...
he looks over...
Got a perhaps inappropriate belief in Dany.
Yeah, and this kind of is a precursor to... more important scene with them, those two that we'll get to here in a minute. But Dany asks the Unsullied if they have chosen their leader, and a man named Grey Worm comes forward, and she's taken aback at their names. She can't believe that they would keep their slave names here, and tells them, look, take any other name except for your slave names. But Grey Worm says, now that brings me pride because it was my name the day you freed me.
Right.
That's who I am now. So it's an interesting look.
The book offers a detail about the Unsullied that it's actually worse than that. Each day, they draw their name out of a bucket from pebbles that have, like, a random adjective
and
noun. That just sounds
so confusing to everyone involved.
Right, this is Martin going too far, because, like, how the fuck do you have a military hierarchy where everyone has different names every day? It's like, I understand you're dehumanizing these, and they don't have identities and whatnot, but, like... give him a number or
it's
something.
It's not practical.
No, it's not. It's not. So, like, I actually thought it's a little bit more realistic that they would give them a dehumanized name, but then you keep that. So, you know, when they say report to Grey Worm, you're like, was that Grey Worm on Tuesday or Grey Worm? Yeah.
Yeah. Report tomorrow to Grey Worm. I don't know who that's going to be.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, how, like, that. I liked how Grey Worm stated it. Like, you know, the name I was born with was cursed, and I was sold into slavery, and it came of nothing. The name that I bear now is the name that that I had when you free me. Mm-hmm. So pretty sweet. I did get a chuckle out of their elaborate, like, Batman Begins esque, you know, shifting maze pattern around, like, when she says, "Who is your leader?" and they do all this. Like, did you guys plan that?
Yeah.
Like, do you always keep your guy in the middle until someone says, can I speak to your leader? And you do the, like, Rubik's Cube routine and form of shielded hallway to him? Like,
they're very well trained.
Pretty, a lot of choreography with these guys is what I'm saying.
So then we get to probably the most important scene with Barristan and Jorah, where Barristan tells Jorah that Robert wanted Dany dead, and he never sat on the King's Small Council because Robert didn't trust him. After the rebellion, they talk about the challenges that Dany faces in subduing the Seven Kingdoms. Barristan labels Jorah's reputation in the kingdoms as one of those challenges, which understandably offends Jorah, who says, look, I know you want me to leave, but you don't give commands here. You're not the Lord Commander. I'll leave when the Queen tells me to, and not a moment before.
I don't disagree with Selmy's, Sir Barristan's logic.
Sure.
But it does seem fairly self-serving this early.
Yeah. Like, Jorah's, like, he says, you only joined us a few days ago. Just chill.
Yeah, this
for a
is
while.
Something you do, like, when they're about to embark to Westeros and you start talking about how you're going to win loyalty and all that kind of stuff. And, like, do we really want a man who's a disgraced slaver, you know, at the head of this former slave army? That seems like a, you know, propaganda coup for the other side that's going to hurt your chances of winning hearts and minds. Like, yeah, maybe Barristan should have just pumped the brakes a little bit. But
yeah,
he's not Barristan... Sir Pump the Brakes. He's Sir Barristan the Bold. So I guess it's in his character.
And he has been from day one. I feel like this is nothing new from him.
Yeah, yeah.
He comes in and questions everyone's loyalty and thinks he's got the key to it all.
Right. Plus, like, I mean, you can see, like, there's this arrogance of this. Because, like, I think... Sir Barristan probably does have a little bit of disrespect towards Sir Jorah, and the idea that, like, I was a king, like, you know, I was a Kingsguard, and being a Kingsguard meant something, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
And what do you
know?
And
I've never been a slaver.
Exactly.
I know your reputation.
I've been earnest and upright my entire life, and I've never fallen. And there's only this boy, this shit boy king that dismissed me. Yeah, I'm not saying he doesn't have a reason, but also probably been better. Of course, again, he says I had no taste for politics.
Yeah.
All right. But the other thing you're supposed to understand here is if you recall back in season one, you know, Ser Jorah was Varys's man inside that was infiltrating Dany's camp and was complicit with keeping the, you know, them informed on her whereabouts and was kind of part of the murder plot until he decided to switch sides and portray. So there's this desperate prodding to Barristan to see what he knows and if he knows that deep dark secret that he has, and there's this and you know, he kind of relaxes a little bit and rolls tough on him once you know, Ser Barristan, to his satisfaction, said, "Nah, I was on a king's council because the king didn't trust me, and I hated politics anyway." So,
yeah, and I think if he had that card, he would have played it by now.
Mm-hmm.
Being bold. So the Karth Starks have abandoned Robb. It all came true. Talisa tries to help, but doesn't even know where they are on the map. So Robb decides to educate her a little, and while he's doing that, he has an idea. He's going to petition Walder Frey to give him the troops he needs to take Casterly Rock from the Lannisters. Because he can't attack him at home, and he can't force them to come out and meet him on the battlefield where they're weak. So scoop out Casterly Rock.
And he doesn't want to go back to Winterfell because, as he points out, if they retake Winterfell and winter comes, winter falls, his men will be, you know, feel like they accomplished something. They'll be have their bellies full, and they'll be with their families, and they'll be warm, and don't want to march south through, you know, dozens of feet of snow. Fuck this. So
yeah,
it's this is kind of desperation, because if this doesn't work, then and the linchpin in his plan is to get Walder Frey on his side and to have him join.
He's already scorned.
Yeah. So.
I know I didn't want to take your daughter, but I will take your troops.
Yeah, we'll take all your troops.
I will take a lot of troops, please.
And, yeah, I'll take all that.
So then we go to Sansa asking Margaery when she can marry Loras, whom they're watching spar. A squire named Oliver helps Loras all the way out of his armor and into his bed. And afterward, it's revealed that Oliver works for Littlefinger, and Oliver informs him that Sansa is going to be married to Loras. So Littlefinger goes to see Sansa, who seems to be wavering on the idea of going home just yet, now that she's been promised a husband.
Yeah.
Littlefinger, it's interesting in this scene. I love the position he's in, because he thought he had kind of won Sansa over. Margaery and Olenna came in and made her this promise, which tempted her. And now he goes in very cautiously in this scene, and he doesn't try to force the issue. He sees that he's got to back off and he's got to take another route in his political scheming. I think it's really well played by Littlefinger.
I think he's also testing to see how much Sansa is a part of this, because if she had no idea of this plot, it seems like a no-brainer that she would jump on the ship and get back with her family.
Right.
But, you know,
she's definitely on board, so he backs off, which is smart.
Yeah, it's a little annoying to me that, Ser Loras is a much more serious and impressive and cool figure in the books, where in the show, time after time, it's just har-har, Loras is gay.
Right.
So they simplify the court intrigue quite a bit by just having Loras stupidly and kind of non-sequiturally blunder that, my intended doesn't even know that I'm gay. I guess it's it ties up this stuff in two episodes instead of God knows how many it would take.
Mm-hmm.
Still, Loras, they didn't do right by your character, man.
Yeah, no, I they really didn't. It's unfortunate. They could have played that a lot better.
Yeah.
And then finally, Tywin calls Tyrion and Cersei together to discuss the plot to marry Sansa off to Loras. He has to educate Tyrion as to why Sansa is the key to the North, which annoys him. Everything annoys him, though. And why the plot by them is such a problem, by the Tyrells. To solve it, Tywin tells Tyrion that he'll marry Sansa and get her pregnant to secure the North. And Cersei drinks up Tyrion's shock and dismay.
Good.
Until Tywin also springs a surprise on her. She's going to marry Loras to secure the Reach, which she very much does not like.
Because, because she's already married off the one man who's mm-hmm. going to, like, ignore her and mistreat her, and now she's getting married to a man that's not going to even ever be interested in her.
Yeah.
And what an insult and shock. But any sympathy I would feel for her has been robbed by the delight that she has in tormenting Tyrion and giving this permission. And also the Stark girl by comparison, because, like, what a hell. Like, Tyrion sees the hellish fate to be married to, like, your arch enemy and the family that killed your father. And to me, like Sansa dreams of marrying some knight, and she thinks she's going to marry Ser Loras, and now she's getting married to the freak of the Lannister court. Like,
yeah,
that's, like you said, that's cruel even for you, which is sad to hear Tyrion say, but also very true.
Well, look on the bright side. Now the Lannister children have something to bond over.
Yeah, they're all
both being married off to people they don't want to marry.
They're kind of hating, loathing for their father.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that, like, when she tries to, like, she first tries, like, the proud, like, I will not be married off like some broodmare, and Tywin's like, fuck yeah, you will. And then when she tries to, like, you know, plead as a daughter to the father, and he just, like, slaps the table and says that all my children have been a disgrace for my name, and that you're going to put an end to these disgusting rumors. Like, is there any one of his children that Tywin loves? It seems like they're just all fall short of his mark of perfection that he himself set. Like, Jaime, you know, foolishly went off and joined the Kingsguard that, like, you know, complicated the family legacy, and now Cersei's doing this, and Tyrion's always been a disappointment. It's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, and this is Tywin's effort to retake the reins here. And I think it works. I think both of these children are cowed.
What are they going to do?
I don't see them having a way to really fight Tywin.
Because, like, Tyrion could go, the only way Tyrion could appeal this, or either of them, is go to Joffrey.
Yeah.
And Joffrey thinks it's super funny to do this to Sansa and Tyrion. Mm-hmm. And, like, he's kind of got this antipathy towards his mother, too.
Right.
Like, I think he's cruel enough to recognize the irony of that. And also, maybe in a creepy way, he'd rather be with his mom be with someone that's not going to make the moves on her as a woman. Because that saves his perverted teenage brain from having to think about it.
Sure.
So there's, like, no recourse. You've got essentially the most powerful man, except for the crazy teenage boy who's not going to help you either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's depressing.
That's all bad for Tyrion and Cersei, which not happy to see that happen to Tyrion. Cersei, yeah, maybe. Maybe. I think Cersei gets what she deserves.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
But that's the end of the episode.
And then again, you know, Cersei, she's a poster child of another, like, I understand where she's coming from. I don't condone it, you know, because, like, she's got multiple reasons for being the shit human being she is. She steadfastly refuses to rise above it. And that's where, before we get to feedback, hey, have you heard that Bald Move has a club? It's super cool. It's super swanky and exclusive. Go to club.baldmove.com to get the many benefits. Prime benefit is you enable Bald Move to keep making podcasts. That's pretty cool. A lot of people seem to enjoy it. It's a gas for all involved. Why not support it? But also you get a lot of other benefits like ad-free feeds, exclusive bonus video and audio podcasts and video podcasts like Lunch with Jim and Aaron and Quit Your Pitchin'. Video versions of most of the podcasts that we do, so you can watch us record it live. It's the fastest way to get a podcast like that. VIP access to forums, just a ton of special features. You can preview them all for free. You can try and sample them at club.baldmove.com before you buy, and you get a 30-day risk-free trial just by signing up. club.baldmove.com. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character, Furiosa. Starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role, and the mighty Thor, Chris Hemsworth, as the warlord, Dr. Dementis, Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. All right, are we ready to consider some feedback?
Yeah, let's do it.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. You can also discuss amongst yourselves in a spoiler-filled thread on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. First up, Christopher D. Aaron, you're writing a book on this subject. Maybe you know the answer. Back in Season 2, when Rob gets married to Delisa, it's a wedding of the Faith of the Seven. Yet Rob is from the North, his wife is from Philantis, neither of which follows the Faith. Do the old gods not have their own wedding ceremony, or is this some sort of integrating mechanism that has replaced weddings in the North, similar to knighting ceremonies following the Seven? You're mostly in the right that, first of all, this was a controversial scene to a lot of book readers because most of Ned's children, with the notable exception of Sansa, prefer, I guess, the old gods, if they prefer anything, with Sansa kind of liking the Seven because she's trying to be like her mom, who is a Southern. And who holds to the faith, and also the faith, the Seven, is what provides all the chivalry and the concept of knights and that things, the beautiful stories that she likes to hear so much. So a lot of people are like offended that Rob would be married by a Septon, forgetting the fact that Ned was married in a Sept by a Septon to Catelyn and didn't renounce his faith. And also, like, something that I've learned a lot from my writing partner, Dr. Anthony Ladon, is that there's this concept called syncretism, where when cultures, like, there's two ways that cultures can intermingle, like through war and conquest, where something consumes something else and it kind of gets, like, you know, just completely destroyed and subsumed, or like can mingle. Like, for example, you know, if you look at a lot of the rituals and holidays around Christianity, Christmas and Easter, ostensibly they're about the birth and death of Jesus Christ, but also, you know, what's up with the trees? What's up with the rabbits? What's up with the, you know, if you go back in those, it's because they're like different pagan faiths, like Saturnalia and solstice being blended in to kind of like make it all palatable. And there's a lot of examples in Westeros. For example, the High Septon's priestly rod is carved out of a weirwood tree. When most proclamations are in the light of the old gods and the new, there's this idea that these societies have kind of like you know, after thousands of years of living together, kind of blended one into the other. There's Seps up in the north, and there's still, you know, stubby little Godswoods down in the south. So I'm not that upset with the idea that Rob would get married, nor do I know or I think that there's ever been identified like a like an official old gods ceremony. I'm pretty sure that, like, the wildlings or the first men, they would just probably, like, everybody knows we're an item, right? And then that would be it. But yeah, so I'm not really up in arms. I didn't think it was that big of a, like, a change from the book Rob's character. And it's all that concept of syncretism, which we talk about a lot in the book. So thanks for the stealth plug, Christopher. Roger Dotsy, long-term Bald Move fans, personal arrogance fans will know him as Roger Connect the Dotsy. Says, the order of the scenes in this episode always kind of irks me. I have no idea why they have the scene with Tywin announcing the marriages of Tyrion and Cersei as the very last of the episode, because I find it fairly anticlimactic. They could have ended with Grey Worm announcing he'd keep his name with the triumphant music cue. They could have ended it with Jon Snow and Ygritte in the cave. More importantly, they could have and should have ended the episode with Jaime and Brienne and their bath scene. Just think about it from a storytelling perspective. Have the penultimate scene be Tywin denouncing his children as disappointments, then swing over to Harrenhal immediately after. Jaime comes in with his Jaime-ness and just hops into the same tub as Brienne. Just when the audience is thinking, oh god, more Lannister bullshit, you throw in the 180 of his long-standing despair over his reputation. I think it would be a much more compelling juxtaposition. Not to mention, I find the ending of the episode on a satisfying dramatic beat is just more compelling TV. Why would they end with this air of bitter disappointment? Just this season alone, we've ended at episodes with the reappearance of Barriss and Selmy, the capture of Jaime and Brienne, Jaime losing his hand, and Dany getting her army. And that's just the season.
I think you answered your question. There's a lot of Jaime endings in this season. I think they didn't want to just do another Jaime climax. It seems like a foolish reason, but I bet that factored in.
Yeah, like anytime, like it seems like something where it's an artificial sense of balance or fairness. Like, because I kind of found myself really agreeing with Roger here.
Yeah,
and thinking, you're right. Almost any of those standalone scenes would have been a better, like, more Games of Thrones ending than this melancholy. Like I said, this resentful family dinner that goes into Shireen singing the goofy patch face song.
I mean, unless that's the vibe you're going for at the end of the episode.
I think that
the Jaime thing would have been a little bit different.
You don't think that Shireen could have played out Jaime's, like, you know, my name is Jaime. Like, I'm like when she calls him the Kingslayer and he goes, my name's Jaime.
Yeah, I think it would have been a different vibe to it.
Because that's pretty bit. And I also really like the idea of, you know, Tywin ranting and raving about his disappointment of children and going to Jaime, where should have been his finest moment, is turned into the thing that everyone throws in his face.
No, narratively, I think, like, you make a compelling case. You end this with Jaime and Brienne in the bath right after that Tywin scene. I think it is more effective, but also I do think there were probably some strange concerns in the writer's room. That caused them to not go with that ending.
Too much Jaime. There's a massive
too much Jaime. They Jaime very much revolt. Wanted a specific feeling at the end of this episode.
Anti-Jaimites.
Yeah.
Finally, last non-spoiler email before we get to the spoiler section. Jared C. Just a random question. I was doing some browsing on the Wiki of Ice and Fire webpage and was wondering, was it ever established how far south the White Walkers made it during the Long Night? I didn't see anywhere specifically stating that, but I didn't do any in-depth research. It just seems to me that they didn't make it very far past what is currently the Wall, maybe just into the northern towns. So for a long time, a lot of people speculated that maybe they made it as far south as Winterfell, thinking that in the mist of time, the name Winterfell was named because that's where the Night's King and the Winter, like, you know, met their end. But then a couple years, was that 2014 or 2015, when The World of Ice and Fire, the big kind of encyclopedic companion piece came out, and one of the entries about the River Rhoyne mentioned that during the Long Night that the Rhoyne froze as far south as its confluence with the Selhoru River. Now, I know that no one knows where the hell that is unless you're sitting in, and looking at a map, but if you do, and you go, you compare latitudes, that's as far south as the mountains of Dorne. So damn near all of Westeros and a lot of Essos froze during the Long Night. It was, you know, it's certainly pockets of human resistance, including probably Winterfell,
But it was a it was a serious thing, and it's again, like we've said over the last few weeks, that this was a worldwide cataclysm, which is why you have all the different disparate myths and prophecies about, you know, the Long Night, Azor Ahai, the last hero, the prince that was promised. They're all from slightly different takes on the exact same phenomenon, because it's something the entire globe of Martin's world experienced, or at least the northern hemisphere of it. And that is the non-spoiler email. Again, if you'd like to send us more, please do so, gameofthrones@baldmove.com. We will consider it next week. But without further ado, let's get into the spoiler section. Jim.
Yeah.
Our Theon torture count stands at a hefty 4 out of 5 episodes. Because
no,
we didn't
Theon
have any
in
Theon.
Yep.
Got a little bit of a respite. Do you have any things that you wanted to talk about?
Yes. Yes. This scene with Sansa and Littlefinger and this whole Loras thing, you can see one of the dual pieces of Joffrey's fate clicking into place here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Littlefinger being denied, like, this one avenue has to pursue, you know, another avenue. He's got to get Sansa out of there, and he can't do it while this promise of Loras is still on the table.
Yeah.
And I think there's something later on, I can't remember exactly what it is, but it changes Olenna's view of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so she helps out with that plot, and you can really see that, like, this is the catalyzing moment.
Yeah.
For that.
It's funny because on this rewatch, everything is so laid bare. Because I talked about, like, you know, Tywin writing those letters, and I think they're telling the story throughout, like, this episode, like, where Locke comes bopping up to Bolton, be like, hey, look what I found, and I fucked him up real good, boss. And he's like, you son of a bitch, how dare. That's because he's gotten a letter setting up the Red Wedding, and the last thing he wants to do is antagonize the Lannisters.
Yeah.
Because
he doesn't
want
to have to explain to Tywin about the
hand. And Locke is really confused because, like, we're still the king of the North's men, right? But he's not high enough in the chain to you know, obviously uncover that plot. And also the fact that, like, Tywin is talking about these plots is supposed to kind of set your mind and thinking, like, what other plots might be in motion that we don't know about.
Right, the ones that Tywin has but doesn't talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a lot of really interesting things when you're watching and you know what happens. You can see this unfolding in plain sight. But
yeah, I can't remember Olenna's half of this. Like, Olenna and Marjorie, do they just realize that Joffrey is a completely uncontrollable asshole and is dangerous to Marjorie, and so they want to kill him and get her with someone a little more reasonable? Is that why they team up with Littlefinger? Because I understand from Littlefinger's perspective, he's got to remove Loras from the equation. Or
he's got to remove
Marjorie as queen from the equation. Because if he can do that, then there's nobody to promise Sansa to Loras, right? Because they're all like, oh, we're going to wait until after I'm queen, give it a while, then I can tell Joffrey.
See, I think that the way he saw the rungs of the Ladder of Chaos is, oh, you know, I might be able to maneuver and figure out ways around, like, Loras, but, like, Tyrion Lannister would be a lot harder to move against. So what I'll do is I will just kill Joffrey. It will be blamed on Tyrion, and then I can spirit Sansa out. I think that's how his kind of calculus went down.
Yeah, so the change comes when
I also
Tywin's
think that
plot,
like
right.
I think the change comes because there's an episode that's coming up as part of this aftermath where Roz gets killed, and there's the, you know, that Joffrey, like, killed this woman with a crossbow, maybe involving Marjorie, and maybe that's where it's like, this guy's just too he's just too fucking crazy. Like, as talented as Marjorie is in manipulation, there's no way that we're going to be able to just manage this situation. So that's, I guess. I honestly don't know, because it's been so long since I've read the third book in its entirety. I've certainly been brushing up and researching the book and stuff, but just sitting down to read it, and I'm not quite sure what happens at the end of this season versus what happens at the beginning of the next season to kind of, like, set these events in motion. But
it's been a long time since I've seen these seasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something obviously happens to do. I wonder if Littlefinger, I can't remember this either, if Littlefinger and Olenna have some kind of deal to let her have King's Landing if she stays out of his way in the north. Is there some kind of, like, joint effort to take over Westeros with via Marjorie and Sansa?
I don't think so. I think Lady Olenna's payment is to get, you know, her daughter still be the queen, which
makes
Highgarden so powerful. And yeah, then later
but she
when the
teams
faith...
up with Littlefinger, so Littlefinger right. presumably would want her out of the way in the north, right?
Who? Who are we talking about?
Olenna.
Why would he think Olenna would fuck with him in the north?
I mean, because she has King's Landing and it's the Seven Kingdoms.
You know, like, we're talking about it. It's kind of odd to me that... I wonder what Tywin's plan for Littlefinger was. Because he has given him, essentially, Harrenhal and the Vale.
Mm-hmm.
And if he lets him have, like, clearly he's going to give his son the north, but, like, that right. puts Littlefinger, like Harrenhal is extremely wealthy, the Vale is extremely powerful and, you know, has pedigree. Like, he's going to be a force, especially if we go with the show route where we find out that the Lannisters are secretly broke.
Yeah.
Like, that seems foolish for Tywin to put such a cunning and intelligent and ruthless person with that much power.
Yeah, I think Tywin is making a mistake here.
Yeah.
He's trying to correct it,
right?
You know, with the Sansa thing,
right?
But
right, right.
He doesn't realize, I think, that Littlefinger is making moves to take the north.
Maybe
Sansa.
He's underestimating him. He's yeah. also
because
like,
he's giving him, you know, some powerful pieces, but ultimately yeah. Tyrion's going to be in charge of the north.
And the fact that he's secretly broke is, you know, something that maybe gives him a little bit of enough desperation that he's willing to take risks that he otherwise wouldn't do as a person as wealthy as people think he is.
Yeah.
He's
playing with fire, though, because, you know, Olenna, when she goes down the list of things she's given King's Landing,
yeah,
the Tyrells have given King's Landing,
right,
that's the only thing that's going to see them through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Tywin upsets that, overturns that apple cart.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he's got the apples to feed his people.
Mm-mm. I also thought it was very bittersweet, Gendry's faith in the Brotherhood, when you find out that they sell him down the river, or up the Red Woman's River in a couple episodes. Like, it's a very cute scene, but the whole time I'm like, oh, man.
Yep.
Wait, just you wait. There's also that, like, talk of Beric Dondarrion about how every time he comes back, he's a little bit less.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't really actually do anything. Like,
no, they haven't done a damn thing with that.
I think this Beric thing and Lady Stoneheart exists in the book just to make you think, like, just to have you concerned about what will happen to Jon Snow when he comes back to life. And mm-hmm. I think Martin has this whole clever, like, warging into ghost kind of strategy to sidestep that, and the show just doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Because there's a couple of throwaway lines where Jon's like, you know, I might not be quite myself, or I don't, but
it never manifests.
Nah, he's
physically.
Still yeah. like, he's never not acted in a different manner than pre-undead Jon Snow. So
yeah,
there's also like a little bit of Chekhov's Caches of Wildfire.
Right. Talking about where they're all buried, you know,
right.
under the Sept.
Exactly. Which, you know, there's a lot of people that are very convinced that the book will not involve this big, like, wildfire conflagration of, I've kind of agreed, but man, they really laid, to me, that everyone likes and wants to chalk that up as to the Double D's just, like, really consolidating things.
Mm-hmm.
But them laying the tracks this far out makes it seem like maybe it's not on that big a scale where they just eliminate all characters that are not, like, 12 that we care about, but.
Right.
Maybe that would be something, because there's only a little bit, like, when Tywin dies, Cersei torches the hand of the king's, the Tower of the Hand, as kind of like, I don't know, because she's batshit. And maybe they just took that and inflated it up to be the Great Sept of Baelor on fire, but
is there any chance that there's more wildfire still to be set off? And that Dany somehow ends up in that and becomes essentially what King Aerys thought
uh-huh.
he would become, a dragon,
right.
at the end of this.
What was that?
Dany,
yeah.
right? So King Aerys, as Jaime describes it, thought
right.
he would burn up and become a dragon.
Which he's a long line of Targaryens, like Joffrey was saying last episode, they're the one that drank
it to
wildfire yeah. to think that he was going to become a dragon, yeah.
Is there any chance that actually happens to Dany? She burns up in a wildfire in King's Landing explosion.
Becomes
like, Cersei becomes the Mad Queen, sets it off, burns herself and Dany alive, but Dany survives.
Well, I mean,
because we've already seen her survive.
Absolutely could happen.
Right.
But her turning into physically turning into a dragon, I doubt it. It's a little too high fantasy for me.
Me too. Me too. But definitely it could be an interesting way for her to survive that wildfire and become the queen.
Right. Because I think she's already metaphorically become the dragon.
Yeah, yeah.
And speaking of that, I also really liked the transition from Shireen talking about the history of Aegon the Conqueror and his conquest of Westeros, and then the Targaryen theme starts playing. They smash cut to Dany and her army.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I see that, and I'm like, it's no wonder the fans get a little impatient with Dany and Meereen, because here in the middle of season three, they're really wetting our appetite for her to come over and kick a lot of Westerosi ass, and it's going to be four more seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Four more seasons. that's all the kind of spoiler things I wanted to point out, but we got a ton of stuff from the fans. Shall we get to it?
Yeah.
All right, Lauren M., I'd like to know what Varys did to that man in the box. Any thoughts on the voice Varys heard in the flames?
I assume he made soup out of his genitals and fed it to him. I don't know.
Maybe he fashioned a new set of genitals after the warlocks. Like, it's like an eye for an eye, a dick for a dick,
mm-hmm.
ball for a ball. It's a very old God's testament.
I would like to know, too, though.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of man is Varys? What does Varys' revenge look like?
I think he might get fucking medieval on this guy.
Yeah.
Like, that might be his
very,
indulgence. I think
very least he's going to cut him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The same way he cut Varys.
Oh, yeah. And then give him the little finger for use for the people with unusual appetites.
Maybe so.
The thoughts on the voice of Varys heard in the flames. This is interesting because it's something, you know, one of the stretch goals we had on our Kickstarter book on this religion, the Gods of Thrones book, when we decided to, like, you know, make it a supersized feature, we started going through and looking at some of the more obscure. And one of the things we started researching is, like, you got all these, like, the Woods Witch, Maggie the Frog, you know, the Magi over Mary Mazder. That killed Drogo, or, you know, did all that crap. You've got the warlocks of Preet, and, like, you know, what is their deal? And, you know, like, Anthony's been opening my eyes to, like, a lot in, like, ancient times, you know, like, magicians or sorcerers. Like, if the townsfolk liked you, you were, like, their shaman. But if they were, like, afraid of you for whatever religious, like, you know, if there's a woman that lived out in the woods and she knew how to cause a girl to have an abortion, like, people might hate her, but also make use of their services, and they would, you know, call her a witch or whatever as a way to, like, you know, kind of ostracize her, but still make use of their services. And I think that, you know, in this world where, like, magic is actually real, you have these people that are serving these arcane forces. But that goes back to the big question of, like, are there real gods?
Yeah.
If they're not gods, if they're just an understanding of these elemental forces, then there could be independent ways to tap into those with ritual. And mm-hmm. and also, like, how much of the ritual actual works? Like, you got Thoros, who said the prayer about, you know, return your lord, or to return your servant to the light. He said that a million times. He said a funeral rites a million times. This time it worked, and it's a surprise to him. Mm-hmm. Like, that dude that cut off Varys's dick and threw it onto a brazier, and blue fire came, and the guy, like, maybe that's just one of the effective ways you could call upon that uncanny power. There's not a lot of mm-hmm. guidance here, and but, you know, that's what our book's all about, is, like, trying to look at real history to, like, you know, answer some of the gaps that are in the Martin's world building and source material.
I think Jamie should throw his hand in the fire, see what happens.
Yeah, might as well.
Just try it.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
Lord
you got
of Light, here you go.
You got a hand with, you know, like, if not King's blood, then hand's blood.
Yeah.
You got Lannister hand's blood. Like, it's just going to waste.
Just try it.
Just go in the waste.
What's the worst that could happen? You burn up your already dead hand.
You burn up and you give yourself, you put down a 5% deposit on your own cremation. You're going to need it anyway, unless you plan on living forever. Who do you think struggled more to get on the High Council, Varys or Littlefinger?
Struggled more to get on the High Council?
Mm-hmm.
Probably Varys.
I think so, too.
Because he, like I mentioned earlier, he was serving the Mad King before this.
Uh-huh.
Robert probably had some questions for him.
Mm-hmm.
Probably side-eyed him a bit before putting him on the council.
But even that, like, Littlefinger can feel sorry for himself all he wants. He is a minor member of the nobility.
Sure.
He was a ward of River Run. Like, he was treated he doesn't have a lot of lands, doesn't have a lot of money, but, you know, his dad had fought his way to a title.
Mm-hmm.
Varys is a street urchin who is a eunuch, double cursed in the eye. Like, he's not a man, he's not a woman, he's a freak. They don't like that. They don't like that he's a foreigner. Mm-hmm. Strike two. They don't like that he's a poor, wretched street. Like, It's amazing. It is amazing that Varys is able to climb to the heights that he was able to. And just through his sheer usefulness and intelligence and ability. He's really a sell. They took his bootstraps away and he still lifted himself up by them. third point and final one from Lauren. If Joffrey didn't die, do you think Margaery could have been a good influence on him? taking him away from Cersei and maybe quell some of his violent tendencies.
No.
I think you give a violent psychopath a beautiful woman and it's not going to end well.
No.
Like, he's got problems that need medication and professional therapy to solve.
Not many therapists in Westeros. Last
also, like, don't forget that he's the product of brother and sister fucking. Like, he could have some chromosomal fucking damage. Mm. Like, it's not just psychotic. He could be like Mad King, like genetically, which is a lot. You know, that's also a lot of problem with the Targaryens too. Jeff P., I've been listening to endless hypothesizing about who will or will not die in the final season, with many people predicting that Jon or Dany or both will die. To me, such a prediction misses an obvious feature for the story that both Jon and Dany are already dead. I believe Jon killed in the mutiny and Dany killed when she jumped onto the funeral pyre of both reanimated avatars of R'hllor, each reanimated with a predestined role to play in combating the White Walkers. Only when considered together do they fulfill the prophecy of Azor Ahai, as each fits separate criteria. Also, neatly, they'd become the Song of Ice and Fire. I believe that only after the White Walkers are defeated, with both Jon and Dany so seemingly surviving the victory, do we get to the bittersweet end, which is Jon and Dany collapsing in death mere seconds after the last White Walker is defeated. Interesting. As alluded by Davos in Season 6, I predict a horrifying twist of fate. Will be the Lord of Light is an actuality and all-powerful malevolent deity, now free of his adversary, the Great Other. R'hllor is free to toy forever with his Planetosi subjects. I like the first. I think it's a pretty sweet idea to have them just drop dead after they've served their purpose. I don't know if I actually think it's going to happen. I really don't
Yeah, I don't know. They kind of lean into that idea conceptually, though I know it's not really directly connected with, you know, killing a White Walker.
Right.
It kind of destroys all their whites.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a loose thread to unravel there. I don't know.
Yeah. But I don't... I mean, it's not a bittersweet ending to have R'hllor end, to unleash a millennia of suffering and devastation to Westeros. That's just bitter and horrific. Mm. But like the two heroes dying because you find out they were just, you know, zombies serving a greater fate, that'd be kind of cool. Phil W. from Australia. In context of the later seasons, do you believe that the mention of the Golden Company by Cersei in Season 7 and by the Knights in the last episode... and also them getting their own segment narrated by Ser Jorah on the Season 7 Blu-ray. I didn't know about that. Means they'll make a significant appearance in Season 8. As we know, the Golden Company themselves were formed out of the remnants of the old Blackfyre Rebellion, led at the time by Bittersteel. In the books, John Connington is one of the top men and is currently capturing Storm's End for Aegon. They are both heavily devoted not just to the Targaryens, but also to getting home. I believe in the show they may turn cloak against Cersei and unite with the Targaryens, possibly choosing Jon Snow as their liege rather than Dany.
Yeah, which would be actually an interesting parallel with what Tywin did with Robert, right?
Yeah.
When he came to siege King's Landing. I think, that's a distinct possibility. I think the Golden Company will show up in Season 8.
For sure, but will they be able to get in the backstory? Because, like,
it's cool
that they do that stuff in the, you know, the lore sections of the DVD and the Blu-rays, but, like, not a lot of fans are going to get a chance to watch that stuff. Mm. And is there enough in 6 episodes that they could just tell this complicated story about this old Targaryen... You know, this thing that goes back to was it Maegor the Cruel, it was Aegon the Unworthy and his great bastards, and how that led to a Targaryen rebellion and the Blackfyres and their many defeats and the civil wars and their exile to Essos. Like, that's a lot of shit to unpack.
Yeah,
and they could have been doing
we'll
it
that.
As we've introduced the sellsword companies. They could have introduced this backstory so they could play a pithy 15-second quote from Jorah or. Fucking Dario Nyquilus, and on a previously on, so people would be, oh yeah, I remember that. They just haven't seemed like they've led the tracks at all. Like the only reason you're seeing tracks is because you've read the books and the reference materials.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have known all that. So I don't think they're going to do all that. I think
right.
the Golden Company will be more of just a piece of Cersei's puzzle.
It'll be an explanation for why she still has troops, even though they all got burnt up in the
right.
the chuck wagon.
And it's going to be like, I think they need to do something to tell us what their loyalties are. Though they don't have to explain the entire history of it, I think they need to tell us, "Hey, this is a risky thing for Cersei to do." Because
Company is like they're just like this well-renowned that goes to the highest bidder.
I know, but they also need to talk about their Targaryen loyalties at least a little bit, right?
It would be cool if they brought that up, but then if they could come up with a good way to do that, then like I don't know why they just wouldn't go with Phil's old plot of like you know bringing it into because there's like. God damn, the books have so much, like, potential, like, endings at the place where they're at because, like, there's the whole, like, you know, Varys might be a secret Blackfyre himself and he's trying, this is, like,
right.
the old long con to get the Blackfyres back on the throne. Uh-huh. There's that possibility. There's, like, lots of cool stuff that they have just categorically refused to bring about on the show, which probably means in the books they're not going to go anywhere either. But then again, like... You know, it seems like to me, George and the Double D's are kind of on the outs, and the Double D's are like, fuck you, old man, we're going our own, we're wrapping this thing up however we see fit.
Because we have to? Because you haven't given us shit.
We're contractually yeah. obligated, and we take that shit seriously.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Tiang M, what are your thoughts on something I've been mulling over, at how many levels of subversion there are in the Game of Thrones? I didn't notice this until I started reading the books after season 7, but one of the more interesting levels of subversion in this series is the entire framework of good versus evil. In Western popular culture, whites always associated life, goodness, purity, and righteousness, essentially all that is right, while evil is associated with black, darkness, malevolence, and death, essentially all that is evil. Think about how many fantasy villains have been called something along the lines of the darkness or the shadow or anything else that implies blackness. And of course, you know, parenthetically, you say there's also a lot of racial overtones in that. Which is something that Western popular culture tends to have giant blind spots about. In Game of Thrones, that trope is completely flipped. The number one nightmare scenario in Game of Thrones, a world where murder, slavery, war, theft, rape, and pillaging are ways of life, for many is a world blanketed in white snow and ice, a whiteout, if you will. I mean, the fact that the marquee villains are called the Whites or the, you know, W-I-G-H-T says it all. White is evil and means death. The flip side, the color black is associated with valor, heroics, and self-sacrifice. Despite what it became at the start of the series, the Night's Watch used to be regarded as an incredibly noble cause that only the strongest and brave took a part of. Taking the black was synonymous with virtue and self-sacrifice. So we talked about Jon Snow, our main hero, arguably the most moral and virtuous character in a world like Westeros, spent the better part of his series dressed in black in the Night's Watch. Even after he left the Night's Watch, he continues to dress in black. He also has black hair. By season 7, all of our main heroes, Jon, Dany, Tyrion, Bran, Sansa, and so on, are dressed in black and browns.
Don't forget Cersei.
Cersei, true.
She's not a hero.
She's not. She's bucking the trend. The three-eyed raven, the symbol of omnipotent power and maybe goodness, appears in the form of a black raven. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this kind of like dichotomy. So do you see this as...
I don't have much to add. I think it's an interesting thing to observe, sure.
Yeah, and it's similar like, you know, George Lucas famously put the stormtroopers in white, the kind of like... And he... To kind of flip that, like, good. And of course, he then also dressed up Vader in black on black on black.
Yep.
And then, you know, the heroes kind of had neutral warm. So it's something that people like to play with. It's a subversion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no problem seeing that as Martin's way to, like, you know, what is one other polarity that I can flip in this world to set people, to confound their expectations and kind of, like, make it seem more interesting than it otherwise might be.
So yeah, I think one of those sort of subversions also exists in, like, you know, the R'hllor religion. I think it's interesting that fire is typically viewed as a destructive thing
right.
and a dangerous thing. Here, it's like their salvation. You know, it's their the thing they worship, essentially.
Right. Ben B, after listening to the pod of season 3, episode 3, in which Melisandre tells Stannis he needs to get his hands on some more King's Blood, it occurred to me, What makes King's Blood King's Blood? Is it simply a matter of perception? Even you accept Stannis as Robert's rightful heir because Joffrey and Tommen were bastards. Given what we've learned about Jon's parentage, Robert was never a rightful king. So is King's Blood anyone who believes he's a king? To loosely quote Monty Python, strange women lying in flames distributing crowns is no basis for a system of government.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a great question, and like it's an open question how much of Melisandre's shit is legit and how much of it is fakery, because in the books, she is aware of the fact that like she has vials of shit in her robes where she's got antidotes to stuff and she's got powders that can make flash, and but also she's becoming aware that she's got some real power. And we find out also in the show that she turns out that she's an old crone, something that they kind of hint in the books, that she's actually someone that has a backstory that stretches back several hundred years instead of the youthful and beautiful woman that she actually is. So she's this dichotomy, and you know, we'll see her put this blood curse on a bunch of kings that eventually end up dying. But did they die because she burnt the leeches? Or, like, these are all things that I think Martin wants to be ambiguous. Mm-hmm. He's pulling out the leftovers on us by really straddling that line between what's supernatural, what's ritual, what are things that happen because people believe and want them to happen, so they act in subtle ways to make it so. There, unfortunately, is not a clear-cut answer on that stuff as of yet, Ben.
Seems like in this context, King's Blood would be whatever the practitioner of magic wants King's Blood to be.
Right, right.
To make them feel good about the ritual they're performing.
Right.
Whether it has an effect or not.
Like in the books, since we're in a spoiler town, like Melisandre wants to use, you know, Mance Rayder's blood.
Mm, yeah.
Is he even a king? Like, he's styled as the king beyond the wall, but is he really? Like, what the hell does that...
He wouldn't even call himself a king.
Right, and, like, every Stark has royal blood, because up to 300 years ago, they're all kings in their own right. Mm-hmm. Is that the, you know, does Tywin have royal blood because they were in they were the king of the Rock? Like, who knows? What is, like, are all of the Dornish nobility still got royal blood because they styled themselves as prince and princesses? I don't know. I don't know that Melisandre knows, and I don't know that the Lord of the Light cares. I don't even know the Lord of the Light is real. And I've just written a book about the subject, so
I think it'd be hard to find somebody without King's Blood. Which, yeah. With as much philandering as these kings do.
Bobby B. himself sowed the land shock full of
it. You can
it.
Go to Flea Bottom. Everybody's got King's Blood.
Everybody with black curly hair, just prick them, and you got an unlimited font of King's Blood. Christian... While listening to last week's podcast, I started to think about the characters that have died in the series. I started to wonder which character's death had the largest impact on the story of the series. In my opinion, I think it's either Robb Stark and Tywin Lannister are the ones that really shook up the story.
Oof. Hard not to put Ned in there.
Well, he excluded season one deaths to set up the plot of the story. So it's like...
That seems unfair.
Right.
But...
Yeah.
Like, okay, excluding those?
Because you could go back to, like, John Arryn if you wanted the guy that, like, his death literally kicked off the series. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to, I think it's pretty clear if you disavow book one and season one that, yeah, Robb and Tywin gotta be. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the, you know, Robb was the biggest threat to the regime of the South, and Tywin was the biggest kind of savior, like the person that, if you know, all the else being equal, is the person who could have done the best job of ushering Westeros through this winter. Mm-hmm. Now, I think ultimately it's kind of an empty question because I don't think Tywin could have done anything about the White Walkers because he's just a man. Like, these things are magical threats that need some kind of magic to counter them, and... You know, Jon Snow with, you know, Dany and her dragons. That's the thing that you need, apparently, to defeat these people. So,
So that's a season one, season two death. Who? Drogo?
Oh, yeah, he's season one.
That's a pretty important death, but if it's season one,
it's true. But is it? Because if he hadn't died.
I think so, yeah.
I wonder.
I don't know that Dany's path is the same.
No,
he doesn't die
for sure. But she's got a. I mean, Drogo would have just taken his 100,000 screamers, rode up to the nearest port, pillaged it, forced a bunch of slaves to sail him across to Westeros, and Dany would have, like, I guess, slightly smaller dragons to fight with. But she'd have 100,000 Dothraki. Like, I don't know. Essentially, she would have... It'd be like Season 7 Dany with no Unsullied and small, like, big dog-sized dragons.
But a very different Dany, too. Like, right. I mean, I'm talking, you know, if somebody needs to combat the White Walkers...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Dany needs to be who she is.
She needs to be
not
seasoned,
just
yeah.
there, you know?
Yeah. Bobby F. was thinking about the listener feedback in 304 and how George regrets killing someone. Oh, we got some feedback on this. I'm glad. I'm wondering if this couldn't be Oberyn. I'll try to be as brief as possible in laying this out. In the show, the Dornish plot is a mess after Oberyn dies. Doran doesn't have any real plan. The Sand Snakes murder him for revenge, only do not declare war, raise armies, or do anything. They just sit in Dorne until Varys arrives and continue sucking with Dany. It doesn't seem like the Double D's had any real cliff notes about what to do with Dorne, and they misfired badly. In the books, there's obviously more going on, but no matter how much gardening Gurm has done with the Dornish and Sand Snakes, they still haven't done anything as well. Dorne claims he wants to put his daughter on the throne, but he doesn't really outline how. To my knowledge, Oberyn pops up and feasts after he's perfectly crafted deaths in the first three books. His death isn't a tragic hero's demise, long planned like Ned or Rob or even Joffrey. It's more of a damn that guy was cool, sucks that he's dead, but doesn't do much anything for the plot. Tyrion just goes on, as does Tywin. It doesn't change anything, really, at least not in the moment, except for Doran's secret plans. Seems like it was intended as a yada, 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 5 days later, 5 years later type of death. Is it possible that Gurm realizes that without Oberyn operating King's Landing, it becomes very difficult for the Dornish to actually achieve any outcome in the framework of the story? It seems like his death would either accelerate or derail the Dornish plot, which puts Gurm in a knot as to what to do. As a show watcher... What's your thoughts on this, Jim?
I don't know, because we're so far past Oberyn's death, and now we're really on to...
And the Dorne just...
Laria, right?
Like, fizzled.
Yeah, it totally fizzled until, like, Laria brings her stuff into the equation, but on Dany's side. Yeah. So, like, I guess as a show watcher, I don't... Like, I miss him because he was a cool character, like you said, but
right.
I don't really miss him as far as the plot goes.
Right.
Because a lot of that was offloaded to Laria.
And I don't know that I agree with his central thesis that Oberyn was super cruche, because Doran is supposed to be like Oberyn's intellectual, like intellectual superior in terms of scheming and planning. Like, you know, literally Oberyn was the snake with the rattles, the, you know, the flashy hood, and he was like the fangs everyone sees, and Doran was the snake in the grass that you couldn't see, like hiding behind a flasher Oberyn. So like, Oberyn was good with the blade, but like after the Tyrion's trial, what if so if Doran is just essentially a superior intellect version of Oberyn, then what plot could he not do that Oberyn could do better?
Well, I mean, if I'm playing devil's advocate, look at the Margaery and Olenna relationship,
yeah.
right? Like, I don't think Margaery is as clever as Olenna.
Right.
And she's the one behind the scenes kind of pulling Margaery's strings. So maybe Doran could pull Oberyn's strings a little bit.
But what to what end? Like, do you need a flashy snake showing his fangs everywhere in King's Landing to be successful? I don't know. To me, Oberyn did feel like it was very... Like, I mean, it's one of the best scenes in the books, one of the best scenes in the show. Mm-hmm. Like, and Doran... If they wanted to, could have just been a smarter, more calculated, you know, he's the professor, he's the M to Sherlock Holmes, for example.
James Bond.
James Bond?
Yeah. M to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, no, Sherlock Holmes' brother, like, he's like not as physically gifted, but he's kind of smarter and more capable. He works for an M. Like, I thought his name is M. It's not Moriarty, because that's the arch,
right.
But...
I don't know.
Milton Holmes.
Milton
was his name.
Holmes.
So yeah, I see what you're saying, but like, I just don't see how. And again, we don't. The plot of Dorne is completely fizzled in the show, and it hasn't fully come to fruition in the books. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. If we have the answer to that. Aaron B. has a few guesses for the character he regrets killing. Number one, Lysa, because the Vale stuff is so complex in the books. We have the whole Harry the Heir plot that's completely gone in the show, as well as the show just basically cutting Rob and Aaron after season 6. They seem to have yada-yadded it. The whole Vale army thing in the show and getting them where they need to be in the books may be a shit show. Maester Aemon, who seems like he would be so important as a source of info about the Targaryens and the dragons to Jon and Dany, and he wanted to see her before he died. Gurm may be having trouble getting the whole dragon has three heads thing from the book to work without him. Hmm. I guess that could be, but I don't know. Like, Lysa can't be a debt that he regrets. Aemon might be. Like, he might have regretted not getting him in contact with, so just he could do, like, he could be play this, expository role to just, like, give her everything she needs to know about dragon lore.
Right.
But then, what the hell is Sam's job going to the Citadel? Like,
good question, yeah.
Yeah,
the dragon class.
Right, right. Maester Aemon wouldn't know about that, even though he was a target. I mean, I don't know. It's tough because, like I said, I've been racking my head and I really can't think of a single death that just jumps out as like, oh, yeah, that really painted him into a corner. But I appreciate your guys' attempts at that. Brad T., in your most recent podcast, you were discussing how it seemed very out of character for Jaime to be sitting arrogantly on the Iron Throne when Ned enters the throne room. I actually think it's perfectly within his character. It'd equate to Casey Affleck's Robert Ford and the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford towards the end of the movie. When he's asked what he thought would happen when he killed Jesse James, Robert Ford answers, applause. Jaime expected the same thing. He was young, cocky, insecure, selfish, and seeking approval. He knew he had saved the city and stopped mass destruction, but he failed to realize the reactions and perceptions that others had have, especially because he should have realized that the majority of people didn't know what he knew. He didn't even realize that even though his actions were justified, he should have put on a front of remorse so as not to open himself up for criticism from his peers. What do you think of this explanation?
I kind of like it.
I thought so too. It's the best, the most compelling one that like he thought that because you know how much experience did he have with hard asses like you know Ned Stark
in King's Landing? Probably not much.
So the fact that he, I mean, didn't realize that it was unseemly and like this broken man in the bathtub is then that arrogant, cocky youth that still thought himself as a hero. Bitter that he wasn't treated that way. Seems like it's a... Yeah, I like it, Brad. It's the best explanation I've heard yet. Because that the guy that sat on the throne is not the guy in the bathtub. It's the guy who's lived with that miscalculation for those many years.
Yep.
Karen from Virginia Beach. In watching season 3 with you guys, I realized that the Unsullied are from Valyria. Does that mean their equipment is also white-killing Valyrian steel? I think this might be a misconception that several people have because the people that live in Slaver's Bay speak Valyria, but they're actually the descendants from the old Giscari Empire. And if you see the Giscari as like an analog to ancient Greece, and the Valyrians were like the Roman Empire that then superseded them. Mm-hmm. These were like, so the Giscari were the first empire, and the Valyrians appeared about 5,000 years ago, and with their superior dragon technology. With their air superiority and ability to incinerate entire armies, they overthrew the Giscari Empire. And after 5,000 years, most of the cultural elements that the Giscari used to keep themselves distinct were forgotten, including their tongue. They all spoke Valyrian because that's what the Valyrians insisted on. When the Valyrians experienced the doom of Valyria, like, there's all these cities that were, like, wealthy slave cities started, like, you know, going back to their past, these pyramids and the harpies, and starting to use the cultural aspects that they still had to try to reforge a separate identity and, like, to reforge that old Giscari Empire and take pride in, like, how ancient they were, but they still spoke Valyrian, even though they're not real Valyrian. Yeah, if the fucking Unsullied had Valyrian steel, like, one of their swords would be worth a fucking thousand of them.
Right.
Like, that's, like, how rare this material is. There's no way, but I see why you would get that misunderstanding. When Sam kills the White Walker coming for the baby with his newly found dragon glass, do you suppose all the whites that the Walker made also exploded somewhere else? This should have alerted a whole lot of Walkers that something was going on. I think you're right.
Fair point, yeah.
And I think there's maybe evidence that did, like... You know, what? That's one of the big mysteries. Like, why now? Why are, like, of all the countless winters that have happened since the Long Winter, why are the White Walkers getting all rowdy right now? And there's a lot of interesting theories. If you go back to the spoiler archive, I did a whole segment on, you know, explanations for this to happen. Like, maybe there was in the Long Night, it wasn't like the men defeated the White Walkers. It was more like a peace accord. And perhaps, you know, they were supposed to supply the White Walkers with X amount of healthy male newborn infants. And only Craster is doing that. And then Craster gets fucked over. And who knows? But like, if that's true, then maybe it's the men that have forgotten why they're doing the things they're doing. They're the aggressors and the violation of this compact. Like, what if men are supposed to say south of the wall and the White Walkers are supposed to say north of the wall? In the last 1,000 years, these men have encroached and these wildling populations are exploding. That's a fucking violation of the terms of the peace accord. So I don't know. It's a mystery. Still don't know. Can the three-eyed raven only see in the past if a raven was there to present to witness it, or a tree with a face? Do you know the answer to that, Jim?
I do not.
It's explained in the books. I'm not sure if they say it in the series, that like the first thing a green seer uses to like as training wheels are animals, and these, especially these tree faces, like they're very easy conduits. But as you progress in power as a green seer, you can essentially kind of like do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
But it's like anything that happened in front of a white, these weirwoods are very easy. Those are like the easiest conduits to kind of use. Jared from Kansas City, time to settle the age-old debate. Who is the better first-time lover, Jon Snow or Pod the Rod?
Well, we have multiple people attesting to Pod's skills.
Highly skilled, highly paid King's Landing courtesans at that.
Yes. On the other hand, we only have Ygritte, who has tested John. I feel like the poll data is stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that to be a pun for Podrick.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, as a lover goes, like, I gotta say that Ygritte's probably an amateur. Maybe she's gifted,
well,
maybe she's not.
I don't know how good those thins are, but...
That's what I'm saying.
She's had several lovers.
She's had one boy who is an indifferent lover and a thin who is built like a mammoth, and that's all we know.
Yeah.
You know, like these women like are like the they're at the apex sexual predators, and they were impressed with Pod. So I gotta go with Pod, because yeah, they know what they're talking about. They've seen it all.
on the other hand, it, like I said in that episode, it could be Littlefinger's repayment to Tyrion.
Right.
You know, the favor that he owed him.
Right. Maybe Jon Snow's the first person to invent cunnilingus in Westeros. Fellatio's been, you know, Tyrion blazed that trail many, many years ago, but like, it's no man has ever thought to put lips on pussy before Jon Snow.
No, they don't talk about Podrick's lips.
No, they do not.
They talk about the rod.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. Is that, that's not a
that's
show.
Not
that's
like, canon. I was gonna say, we talk about Pod's rod.
We talk about Pod's rod, maybe a little too much for our health.
Fair.
Willow. Even in these early seasons, a show in the books have had a borderline obsession with A, showing us the Winterfell crypts at every opportunity, and B, having gruff northerner wildmen spit out, "Barn the bodies." So what gives? We all know why the burning. Given this, when did this, and why did the Starks and those following the old gods decide that burial was the way to go? The season 7 finale also had a zombie thudding from inside the box. Who is else is up for season 8 featuring a zombie Lyanna and zombie headless Ned thud-thudding from inside their cask leading right up to the title music?
Huh.
Fucked up, man. I don't know. You got...
You talked about this mingling of religious ideas. Is that part of it?
Syncretism.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting that of the crypts in Winterfell, that they're all guarded by these stone likenesses of the kings and lords, and they all have like these iron swords bared across their laps, which is like the northern way to say fuck off. And also, iron is in high fantasy often like proof like against magic and sorcery. So it's entirely possible that the scheme was set up to like make sure those like restless spirits can't reanimate the dead. I mean, that's one theory I've seen. And then like the Northerners have forgot why they do it, but they still do it because it looks cool. But like those iron swords are actually like, you know, international no sign for whites to reanimate their bodies.
I feel like
I very, very highly doubt that the tombs of Winterfell will empty with a bunch of vengeful, although that would be cool.
Yeah, seeing a headless Ned come back.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's wishful thinking on the part of the people who carry swords to say that iron is some kind of protection against magic.
Yeah.
It's like I can't do magic, and magic seems really powerful, but I got the sword. Right. Maybe that does something against it.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder how that... sure, buddy. Sure.
I wonder how that... Like, are there, like, why does running water detour vampires?
Yeah.
Or garlic? Garlic makes sense because, like... You know, if you want
to
get really...
Nobody wants to be around.
And it seems
garlic.
Like, you know, there's the whole thing of, like, you know, when the Black Death is going across, that they would use strong smells to ward off other strong smells. And, like, you know, you use a good smell to ward off the miasma that's causing it. And so, like, garlic would keep you from smelling the dead bodies that people thought became vampires. But, like, yeah, what? Pig iron and running water. Where the fuck did that come from? Burying them at crossroads because it's cross and that's... form of it, like, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah.
Russell from Australia, I want to touch on a topic where you were discussing in episode 3 about what lands are available to the wildlings. He wanted to point out that in the scene where we see the White Walker being created, that place was shown as a lush woodland, and now we know it's a frozen, desolate place, hinting at the fact that the land of always winter has only been such since the White Walkers were created.
Hmm.
So, like, we're talking about, like, the gift of the, you know, that chunk of land that the Northerners have given to the White Watch as being, or the Night's Watch to be settled. But, like, it could be that all of the lands of Always Winter become, like, some lush paradise that the wildlings and the, you know, who are the other troops that we thought? Oh, Dany's Unsullied could settle.
Yeah.
Cool theory. We'll see if it holds true. Fernando said, rewatching season 3 of you guys and seeing all the Theon torture scenes and how I thought it was the lesser of the season 3 storylines, I kept thinking about Theon's storyline for season 8. If we had to rank season 8 plots, I would say that Theon's story is yet again on the low end. With all the plots that need endings, my question is, how do you think the Double D's will conclude with the Theon story? 20 minute wrap up, constant cutbacks to Theon's story throughout the 6 episodes, just hand wave it all away. What do you think?
Whew, that's a tough one. I mean, I don't... honestly, as a viewer, I'm not looking for, I guess, the final rise of Theon.
Right.
As an important part of the finale.
Right.
Honestly, my interests and loyalties have gone over to Yara.
Mm.
I think she is both a better leader, a more capable fighter at this point, like just a more all-around queenly kind of presence, where Theon, I don't know, I feel like they need to do something with him that gives people a sense of closure on his story, but fuck me if I know what it is.
Yeah,
like he could be, you know,
he
his sister's
had his moment of awesome where he reclaimed his... I mean, I guess that's the thing about Theon. He's this creature that was always jealous and selfish and cared about the fine things he had and his cock. And now those things have been taken away and him finding some sort of self-worth without all those things. And I kind of feel
it's
like...
it's given to him by Yara, right? Like, that's the...
Right. But last season when he beat that man down...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I felt like he kind of reclaimed some of his personal power. So, like...
It's true.
Does he need to rescue his sister? Does he need to die in the attempt? Does I don't know, because, like, to me, you know, Theon already believes in himself, and that's kind of his arc.
Yeah.
Like, that's a satisfying end for his arc. So honestly, I don't really care, and that's a little bit on me because I just don't care about the Greyjoys. I'm kind of chagrined that they've come back flying into the story this late hour, because, like, I'm a famous Greyjoy hater. But
no, I agree. I think he's expendable at this point. Like, he's served his purpose. He's had his arc. You could just throw him at the wall of violence that's sure to come.
It's an interesting email from Jackie D. I was intrigued by your discussion last week about how the fandom would respond if George just admitted he messed up with a piece of the plot that he needed to rework to end the story and just retconned it. She points out that J.R.R. Tolkien made many changes to The Hobbit after it was published in order to make The Lord of the Rings make sense. And I'm just going to paraphrase this because we've gone really long. But essentially, the character of Gollum in the first edition of The Hobbit just had a war of wits with Bilbo, and Bilbo outsmarted him. He just gave up the ring freely because, like, that's the rules of the game. once, you know, Tolkien started writing The Lord of the Rings and the corrupting influence of the ring, he added the desperate, like, you know, my precious kind of stuff to it.
Yeah.
And he retconned it by saying that, like, Bilbo, you know, the story of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings where Bilbo and Frodo wrote these. They're autobiographies and...
unreliable narrative.
Yeah,
that
Bilbo wrote the first version under the influence of the ring to make himself, like, noble and, like, all this stuff.
So
and
you then... really don't know the whole story of Lord of the Rings unless you've read both versions of
so, like,
The Hobbit.
That's like, it's not even a retcon so much as like the in, well, Frodo clean saw, like, he lived through this and he saw his uncle's lies and kind of cleaned it up.
It's like the volume two of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
Told from, it covers the same material but told from a different perspective.
Right. So
of the same character. That's so weird.
George doesn't have that because this is not, you know, this isn't like a discovered tome that's been translated by some stodgy English professor. But like, honestly, that I probably knew that at some point because I used to be a big Tolkien fan. That's pretty shocking, though, that you can make a pretty big change like that to a major character just to smooth over a plot line in a later book.
Yeah.
So there's precedent. You know, George, he's already stole the RR from Tolkien. Why not the retconning?
Uh-huh. It stands for retcon. That's
what it stands. Always be retconning.
Yeah.
So thanks for pointing that out. Jonathan H., I think this is the second to last email. I know there's been some discussion on Varys and his motives, and I know he claims that he's loyal to the realm, but could it be that he's full of shit and just wants to see the whole world burn? So far, he's played both sides without actually gaining anything except for a whole lot of death. If his goal is to just sow as much death and destruction as possible, would it really make sense why he is a spy in Dany's crew? Oh, no, then it would really make sense that he's a spy in Dany's crew. He's just playing both sides with the hope that he can cause as much suffering as possible as recompense for the suffering he's endured.
What a character twist right there at the end.
It's a less interesting one, though, right?
No, I agree. It comes out of nowhere, in my opinion.
I mean, it's there, like the fact that he had everything taken from him by forces beyond his comprehension, and he wants to rise to the top so he can take everything from everyone.
I just think it would be a little disappointing.
He turns him into
the
Joker,
reveal of his character.
Essentially. Yeah, me too.
Yeah. This was all the long con to, I don't know.
But I really like Varys. I'm a Varys lover. So maybe I'm not the most reliable narrator on that as well. Matt H., wanted to follow up on your comments about one of the funniest exchanges in Game of Thrones and get your general thoughts on the comic relief of the series. Thanks for recognizing the hilarity of Pod the Rod and his mysterious neophyte sexual prowess. I'm a little disappointed that this kind of humor seems to be waning as we get closer to the dramatic end of the series. You mentioned on a previous episode that Game of Thrones is a subversion of high fantasy, and to me the irreverent humor is a part of that. Aside from Bronn getting a kick out of pronouncing Dickens' name in Season 7, it seems like humor is being increasingly cut from the script. Is this the inevitable result of needing to tie up so many loose ends in the fantasy that are very dark and dramatic, or do you feel like there's still a place for humor through the end of the series?
Yeah, I view the climax of this story as not really the place for humor.
Right.
And I don't know why, really, because so many dark and truly tragic things were happening throughout the series, and it always felt like the humor kept it watchable in places. But for some reason, as we get closer to the end, I feel like let's jettison some of the stuff that made this interesting in the beginning in favor of making it interesting in the end. And humor is one of those things that needs to be jettisoned, in my opinion.
The same thing happened with Breaking Bad, though, right? Like,
yeah,
one of the things that defined Breaking Bad was its black, kind of skewed sense of humor, and that, as we got further into the plot, just kind of went away, because I guess it's hard to find the humor in Walt being a complete monster and Jesse being tortured by neo-Nazis. Like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, there's still a little bit like the Hound giving Thoros shit about his top knot not fooling everybody. There's a little bit, but like, things are really bleak, and it would be semi-inappropriate for something like Pod the Rod to pop up in the middle of Dany losing one of her children.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even see what I did there. Popped up all stealth-like. It's tough because, like, you know, Game of Thrones certainly known for its humor, or that's part of things. It's well, I don't know if it's known for its humor, but Breaking Bad certainly was,
too,
and
yeah,
it just got less funny as it went on because it's harder, like... People like I'm very sensitive to tonal shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I'm in the middle of a very serious scene and then, like, they come out with slapstick right out, it always is jarring to me, which is why I thought it worked well for, you know, David to just take over an episode and like inject a bunch of humor into it in the early goings before shit gets grim. But think about like what it'd be like if a truly side-splitting scene happened right after the Red Wedding. You know? It would be it's not appropriate to the vibe that the audience is feeling, I guess. So I think they're right to be kind of to shy away from that. Anything you want to care to add?
No.
All right. Well, that's our podcast. I think I finally got caught up because we've had two supersized mailbags to catch up with the stuff that we didn't have, that have essentially taken a week off. We're now caught up. If you'd like to send us feedback, gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Of course, we still have our spoiler-filled thread on the forums, forums.baldmove.com. Thanks for coming along with the voyage with us. Still got several episodes left to go. We'll be back next week for more. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.